This is episode 28 of Nature's Pulse. My name is John Lieber. You can reach me on Twitter or Instagram, which is at @jungle_capital. This is for the week of March 22nd. Let's take a look at this week's environmental events. Okay, so we're going to start this week in Antarctica. Archaeology and paleontology has always fascinated me. I often thought about going into paleontology, but since I chose ecology, I still like to peripherally see what happens in paleontology and archaeology, and it does feed into ecology as well. So this paper came out this week, and it's about the forests that are being discovered and explored of Antarctica through the fossil record. And it's just really fascinating what they're finding. So they're finding tons of fossilized wood and leaves in Antarctica, and they've been preserved so well because of the climate, which is often down to, it says, negative 83 degrees here. Most of these forests are from a supercontinent called Gondwana, which stretched around the southern hemisphere. And as expected, they're finding that many of the species that are unique to Australia are being found in these fossilized records, as well as species that are found in Southern America as well. So you can see here, there's a photo of one of the leaf imprints. They're very well preserved. And they're finding some interesting surprises, like the east side of Antarctica has different forest makeup from the west side of Antarctica. There's amazing diversity of tree species being found. And they're just starting to explore this record. So it's just really exciting and cool to see how this progresses. So let's take a look at the next article. This is a really unfortunate event that happened where a seal that was very popular in London near the Thames River was attacked by a dog and actually killed. The reason I bring this up, and I mean not just because it's just in the week's news, but I do have a thing with dogs and pet ownership that I generally keep quiet because sometimes I feel like it might not be the most pressing of environmental issues, but I think growingly it's hard to ignore what happens. So just to put it into perspective, if you just Google how many birds do cats kill a year? A 2003 study estimated free-ranging domestic cats kill between 1.3 and 4 billion birds on top of between 6.2 and 22.3 billion mammals every year in the continental United States alone, the majority by feral or unowned cats. So that's just cats, and they take a lot of the heat, but we also need to look at dogs too. So if you Google how many animals do dogs kill a year, researchers in Australia, led by Tim Doherty at Deakin University, found that kills by dogs threatened 156 species worldwide and led to the extinction of approximately 10 species. A Polish research group found that in Poland alone, dogs were responsible for killing more than 33,000 wild animals per year. So it's not just this one incident where pet ownership is becoming a problem. It's becoming a major problem as our population grows and as the popularity for owning dogs and cats increases as well. So dogs were originally had a function, and that's what I think a lot of people forget about. So they used to protect livestock and property, whereas increasingly it's becoming for companionship. And it really boils down to a carrying capacity issue. If you think of one dog on a 1,000-acre farm or even a 100-acre farm, it's doubtful that it's going to have that significant of an impact on the wildlife. But when you start getting into city environments where everyone starts owning a dog, and you amplify the impacts of the harassment on wildlife as well as the creation of dog food, and then the pollution of soil and water through their feces. The environmental impacts are quite significant. And I think I've thought about this quite a bit, and I was trying to figure out and articulate why it bothered me so much, and I think that I kind of articulated it quite well here. So when I posted this article, I said, "I can't help but wonder if the desire to own a dog is a band-aid for the void that we've created in our souls, caused by exterminating immersion in biodiversity and replacing it with immersion in concrete. Unfortunately, this modern-day quick-fix band-aid is only creating a flywheel in which the rate of biodiversity loss increases." And the reason I say that is because how I just mentioned about the main reason for owning a dog seems to be companionship, and I think that that companionship used to be fulfilled by wonderment of interactions with other species, and this is sort of a way that our brains play this quick trick on us, where we see another species that's friendly with us, and it gives us the same sort of feeling of belonging and love that we used to get from interactions with natural species. But the problem is with this kind of copy-paste quick fix solution, as I said, it's creating a flywheel where we're losing what we originally had already degraded. So I hope that we can eventually move away from pet ownership where necessary. Okay, so in this week's Environmental Professional History, I pulled up a biography of Giuseppe Antonio Rizzo of France. So here's a photo of him. Giuseppe lived from 1777 to 1845. He was a naturalist, zoologist, biologist, and carcinologist, which is someone who studies crab species. So he named 549 marine genera, and there was four species that were named after him after he passed. So some of these include the Rizzo's dolphin, a genus of gastropods was named after him, a genus of algae, and a lanternfish species was also named after him. So I just want to give Giuseppe a shout out and thank him for his contributions. I also wanted to give one more shout out to Anna Polger. So she was interviewed by me on an episode of Environmental Professionals. She's really inspiring. I'd recommend everyone to go check out that video. So if you just go to my YouTube channel, which is John Lieber Ecology Planning or Jungle Capital, and type in Anna Polger, you'll find that interview and you can see what she's been up to over the last year. But she has graduated from her MSc in Spatial Planning. So I just wanted to give a shout out and a congratulations to her on all her hard work, because right now I'm doing my MSc and I'm realizing how hard of a task it really is, so I can appreciate her achievement. So good work, Anna. Next, we will talk about this really interesting proposal to green the Sinai. So the Sinai, for those who don't know, is the peninsula that connects Africa and the Middle East. It's part of Egypt, and right now it is a desert, expansive desert, aside from some areas in the north which have outlets of rivers that are somewhat lush. But the Egyptians have a lot of interest in this area of land being further utilized for economic and other purposes. And this scientist, and he is an environmental engineer, came up with, and I have to give it to him, it's a very creative and cool solution. So his name is Tiz van de Hoven, and his proposal basically, it's a tactic that was also used in an area of China as well, and they create these small greenhouses with water in them. And what it does, and they place them throughout a small area of the desert in very specific distances from each other, and it creates microclimates. And through this microclimate, so they can start planting weed species or species like hardy species, and that starts to alter the local climate of that area. So the area can be completely desert, and through this process, it allows moisture to articulate or to accumulate, and for the process of succession, which is an ecological term to describe how plant communities progress to forest over time, it kind of starts off that succession process. Not that it would necessarily move to forest, but it would allow for soil to start being built up and more desirable plants to be grown. So the plan is that they would start out slow and place these greenhouses in certain parts of the Sinai in very targeted areas. And then over time, they would expand the placement of these greenhouses and expand the lush area of the Sinai until, as projected here in this rendering, that a vast swath of the Sinai would be lush. So this is extremely in the interest of the Egyptians, because it would stimulate their economy in a major way, because really their eye is set on making this agricultural land. And I think the equation from an ecology perspective needs to be taken is, well, desert ecosystems are not bare, they're full of life as well. And have changing this part of the Sinai on such a large scale would certainly influence weather patterns and potentially have cascading impacts of ecosystems on both marine and terrestrial areas nearby, and it's really hard to know what the climate impacts would be. So you have to think, is the biodiversity benefit of making it lush a net gain, or is it a net negative? It's really hard to know all of the variables, as everything is with a complex system such as ecology. So my thought here is basically that it's a cool idea. It's not necessarily bad for the environment, but I just can't stop to help thinking that it feels like humans are kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel of Earth's resources, because this is quite creative, but we've gotten to this point where we have to innovate in extraordinary ways just to kind of get to the last bit of Earth's resources. So that's kind of the sad part about this, but the more optimistic side shows how environmental engineering can expand our resources. And one more very tragic but important story to talk about is this constant threat to the Papuan forest on both Papua New Guinea and the Indonesian side. So lately we've been talking about the Indonesian side, where Indonesia really seems to be stepping up its interest in developing the side of the continent. And as I've mentioned before, Papua New Guinea is one of the last true areas of raw wilderness, and extreme hotspot of biodiversity as well. So much is not known. So many indigenous people live there. It's absolutely beautiful and thriving with culture, and it should be protected for all of humanity and Earth's sake and interests. But unfortunately, that's not happening. So we can see here that a palm oil firm called Digol Agri has started clearing Papuan forests without the consent of indigenous people. But not only that, there's all types of corruption happening here with this. I think this bottom, well, I'll read the kind of the summary first. So it says, palm oil conglomerate has begun clearing the ancestral forests of indigenous tribes in Indonesia's Papua region without the locals' consent, a watchdog group says. Subsidiaries of Dugol Agri Group have cleared 64 acres, which is, or hectares, which is 158 acres of forest in the first 2 months of 2021, according to satellite imagery analyzed by an Indonesian nonprofit called Puskesa. Dugol Agri has cleared 405 acres in 2019 before suspending operations for all of last year amid a labor dispute. Pusaka alleges that Dugol Agri has failed to obtain the free, prior, and informed consent of local indigenous tribes to operate in the area, which forms part of the Tanah Merah project, slated to become the world's biggest oil palm plantation, which is absolutely frightening. And I've heard murmurs about there being a lot of tension between the Indonesian authorities, who it's not that long ago that they won their dispute over the western side of Papua. And there's a lot of tension between the indigenous people that live there and then people, the governing authorities in the rest of Indonesia. And there is allegations of trying to somewhat control and push away the indigenous people, as happens way too often. And just a note about, like, and it there's a lot of documentation on this, but just to show you how much controversy and corruption has been found in this project. So there's been allegations of falsified permits, conflicts with indigenous peoples, and the use of shell companies in offshore secrecy jurisdiction to conceal the identities of the investors behind the project, several of whom still remain a mystery. So not good. Okay, thanks everyone. That's it for this week's episode. I will say that there is a new episode of Environmental Professionals coming out, hopefully on Monday or Tuesday. I'm excited to release that one. It's going to be really good. And yeah, I'll just say that with my master's program, I'm doing a data management course right now, and the workload is crazy, and trying to learn it all is also mind-bending. So wish me luck, but I'll be back next week and looking forward to it. So we'll talk to you then. Thank you so much, everyone.